This podcast is brought to you by The Province.
Listening to the DGP with province writer Dana G.
Hi, welcome to the DGP with me, Dana G. Now, if you've watched TV or seen a movie in the last 30 plus years, you've probably seen actor Bruce Greenwood in action. Now, Bruce has got one of those resumes that truly embodies the term working actor. Big productions like Star Trek movies, I, Robot, Double Jeopardy. He played presidents in 13 Days. He was JFK. He was in Capote. Dinner for Schmucks, a funny little movie. He's also been on, like I said, on the television set. He started out at a really young age on Beachcombers, which everybody here in Canada will be happy to hear. We love our Beachcombers. He went on to St. Elsewhere, Knott's Landing, and then now, starting in early 2016, I think it comes out, is the new Ryan Murphy FX series, American Crime Story, The People v. O.J. Simpson. This is one of those series that is packed with stars. Go and check it out yourself because I can't list them all here. But the good news is Greenwood's got a big role in that. He's playing L.A. District Attorney Gil Garcetti. But in the meantime, Greenwood, who's spent a lot of time here in Vancouver, lived here for many years, but calls L.A. home, was up here going to the Whistler Film Festival to help launch a new movie he's in rehearsal. Great, wonderful little independent film from Vancouver writer and director Carl Vasai. But more importantly, Greenwood was at the Whistler Film Festival to receive a Career Achievement Award. And like I said, if you look at his resume on IMDb, he certainly has achieved a lot in that career. So let's check in and have a chat with Bruce Greenwood, who, by the way, I'll let you know, we caught on his way driving to LAX to catch a plane to come up to Vancouver. Okay, great. I've got the lovely Bruce Greenwood on the phone from Los Angeles. Bruce, thanks for joining us here.
Well, hi, Dana. Good to be here.
Great. Okay. You're on your way back up to Vancouver. You're
I am.
You're practicing your Canadian?
I can't wait to get up there.
You still spend a lot of time up here?
Yes. Yeah, we'll come up all the time. Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess we should tell people you're coming up because you are being honored, first of all, at the Whistler Film Festival with a Career Achievement Award. As well, you're starring in a new Carl Bazai film, which opens here at Whistler. So let's start, first of all, Career Achievement Award. What does it mean when you hear that sort of thing?
Well, I'd like to think of it as a mid-career achievement award.
Good.
Can we just contextualize it that way?
Certainly. We'll just say that from now on.
So at least so I'm a little more comfortable. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, generally speaking, the Career Achievement Award sort of means, thanks so much. Last call. Lights are blinking. You know,
right.
You can't stay here. You can go home, but you can't stay here. You know?
Yeah.
It's fun. It's exciting.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of a funny thing too, because you, when it comes to careers, I mean, I don't ever even imagine you slowing down at all. Because if you look from probably like the first time people saw you way back in the Beachcombers, since then you've never been out of work. It seems.
I'll do anything.
An actor, yeah. Acts, right, Bruce?
Just a quick glance at my IMDb page will reveal that.
That's true. But that's it. I mean, you'll do anything, but that's what's interesting too, as well, is like the breadth of the stuff that you've done. I mean, you've got some pretty heady, from big directors to big roles. I mean, you have done just about everything.
Yeah, I've been very fortunate that way, to sort of tumble from one thing to another, from small to medium to large. You know?
Mm-hmm. Tell me, well, let's talk before we sort of go into a little bit of a retrospective, seeing as we're talking career achievement. Just let's talk about the new film, Rehearsal. Lovely little film. You're right smack dab in the center of it. You play this sort of, focused, a little bit myopic English theater director who thinks the theater's the only way to go. It's fun to hear you with a British accent.
So, I gather you've seen it?
Yes, I have seen it. I thought it was a really lovely film.
Oh, did you? Oh, good. Mm-hmm. Good. We had a ton of fun making it.
Mm-hmm.
And Carl and David Cubitt and I got together and played around before Christmas, about this time last year, and started just sort of mushing the script in various directions and playing and improvising. And by Christmas, we we all thought, okay, well, let's you know, put the camera on a stand and see what happens. And we had a lot of fun making. It's a really fun character, an old sort of crusty English director who's convinced that the only way to do art and the only way to survive in any meaningful way is to keep it on the stage and do the classics. But of course, he's disabused of that notion pretty quickly.
Right, right. I love the name. I was talking to Carl the other day, the name of the character, Turner Horatio Longfellow. You don't get much headier than that, do you? I told him the only other English name I think that made me smile more is Lancelot Capability Brown is a favorite.
Yeah, yeah. No, I tapped a friend of mine in London for her take on the name. She says, "Oh no, that's such a clear. Oh, that's ridiculous. That's awful." But the more she hated it, the more I loved it. So.
Exactly. Well, he kind of has to be that way, right? Because the character is so decided in how he views things that he kind of has to have a name that has a big statement. I think because he's not a guy that waffles.
No, he's loud and he's not shy. And who knows what came first, the loudness or the name? You know, maybe he had to live up to the name.
True. I have to ask you, watching it, I always think it's interesting when an actor, when you get in there and you're playing a role of like a director or an actor, you actually being in the role of something that you are. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm wondering when you've worked with so much and worked with so many different directors, do you take any inspiration from that? Or is it how do you approach that?
Well, yeah, you take, of course, as in terms of how a director works with actors. Some are good, some are bad, and some are in the middle, mm-hmm. and some don't work with them at all, which is sometimes a great thing. But, you take a little piece from the extreme pieces from people with whom you've worked, and also in terms of, like, sort of the physical behavior. I worked with, a lot of sort of veteran guys over the years, and, each one of them leaves an impression that you can carry with you and take a little piece of. You know?
Mm-hmm. Is it ever a worry, though, it's sort of like, I guess the term might be inside baseball, to go in and play in a role that's about the industry that you make your living in?
It is, of course, but it's also, this is so broad in that context that it's not, we're not trying to, shine a light on what it really is to be a theater actor. Mm-hmm. It's much lighter than that. We're not pretending to sort of offer insights particularly about that experience. Mm-hmm. It's more a glint through a very certain lens of that kind of experience.
I liked about the character, like, you're right, he sort of is a kind of some swept in some broad strokes, but I don't know what it is, but I love the fact that he always had the little teapot with him.
Yeah.
There was a little pouncy little teapot.
And that was just one of those things that just occurred in an instant. We shot the thing so fast that basically you don't have time to reject ideas. So it's in a way it's an advantage because you just, okay, great, okay, let's do that. Got a teapot? Okay, cool. And then it becomes a thing.
Right. You must have, having done so many different things with so many different people, have had to approach work, I guess, in different ways, different formats. How do you prefer? Do you prefer just getting in and getting out? Or are you someone who likes to spend time with the piece?
I really like to spend time.
Yeah?
I like to have the luxury of time, and it just, it's the wrong business to be in if you want the luxury of time.
Mm-hmm.
But, on the occasional day when you're shooting and there's an hour left over and you've basically finished the scene and you can just play. There's a little bit of freedom that happens that's difficult to create when you know the clock is ticking.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things you try and cultivate over such an interminable career as mine is trying to find the freedom to be free when you know the clock is running. But it's tricky,
right?
Because you feel the pressure comes from all kinds of places,
And I guess it depends on the project. I mean, with those bigger ones, there's all sorts of different pressures. Just, can you talk about that a little bit? I mean, you have on that, as you made fun of yourself earlier, IMDb resume. I mean, you're big, big movies, right? The Star Trek films are ones I'm just going to point out for starters. And then you come back and you do something like Rehearsal with Carl that you shoot quickly. Is it just a timing thing with you, or do you search out these smaller bits that you can sort of step away from the green screen, so to speak, for a while?
Well, I'm always sort of running the radar to see what's out there for me, and you know, big, small, or little. And if something happens to the side of the script that looks fun to do, then if I'm free, I'll jump, you know.
And going back and being able to do something like that, is it sort of seemed to me in that movie too, it almost was like you were in a theater troupe.
It did feel that way because we had the advantages of shooting a great deal of it in that big space, you know, in that big theater space in downtown LA. So it helps. And, you know, I know David's done theater and I've done theater, and we've, you know, we have some of those, we can make those references kind of, it's sort of in our blood, I guess, a little bit.
Mm-hmm. The idea of the sort of the smaller independent films, like, it sort of kind of ebbs and flows in the business. You know, we go through a while where there's a whole bunch of those movies. And right now, I know, too, coming out, because it, as they call it, Oscar bait season. So we're seeing more of those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you think, you know, looking at your list of things that you've done and stuff, how important is it to put these little sort of gems or these smaller movies in amongst the big stuff?
Well, it's particularly important for somebody of my vintage because you're unlikely to get roles that last for more than a few pages, you know, unless you're very fortunate. So, you know, and often in the smaller movies, you get a chance to sort of run a wider bandwidth, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So you can have a little more to do, which is always fun. But you know, the trick is to get those little gems for anybody to see the little glimmer that they provide, right? It's very difficult to get them noticed. So,
right.
you better have fun doing it. You better be just happy with the project and really manage your expectations because it's you know, there's a million of them, especially at this season.
Right. And I guess at this time, too, is probably the importance of a film festival like a Whistler Film Festival is an opportunity for these films to get out there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I did a film called Wildlike a couple of years ago, and we spent probably a year and a half or 2 years going to festivals. Like, we went to 150 festivals.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, ultimately it got a sale, and it's a beautiful little movie.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's a lot of people out there in the marketplace vying for that slot, you know.
Also, I guess kind of a new reassuring thing too is these cable networks that are actually producing original content, and you're in the midst of one. I take it, are you shooting American Crime Story still right now, or are you done?
No, we finished it about I don't know, 3 weeks ago or so.
So you've landed in one of these sort of great positions again with these guys. Not only are you on FX, which is, you know, known to do some really great work, but you're on a Ryan Murphy show. We should tell people American Crime Story. It's the OJ one, right?
Yeah, and it was it was 10 episodes long and an exceptionally strong script, and the players were just, everybody was just,
oh, the cast is unreal.
Cylinders, you know. Travolta was just like, whoa, man, it was fantastic.
He plays Shapiro, is that?
Yeah, and you wouldn't, I mean, honestly, Danny, you just go, I mean, you're going to take your hat off and stomp on it when you see it. He's really something.
And you're
really fearless.
You played District Attorney Gil Garcetti in it, correct?
That's right. Yep.
What was it like going back into that story? I mean, the story of the century, the crime of the century. All of a sudden, you're in there, and you're in there with some pretty. The cast, I mean, is amazing. People should just go look it up, and because we don't have the time to list all the talent in this. But what was it like to go back and be in the O.J. Simpson story again?
Well, I've read copious numbers of books, and the more I read, the more I understood that what happens behind the scenes and what the public, what the jury doesn't hear that the public does hear, and what the public doesn't hear. I mean, the fact that justice gets done ever is almost astounding to me.
Mm.
And the other thing I thought was really interesting in Dershowitz's book, he says, okay, say you're a member of a jury, and you are convinced that the police have framed a guilty man. To whom does your obligation lie?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is your obligation to this one case and to convict this guilty man, or is your obligation to impugn the system that's being abused?
I guess that's pointing to the Mark Furman stuff.
You know,
that's
a really interesting dilemma. And there's a different answer. Everybody has a different answer.
Mm-hmm. And did you come away with a different opinion of the whole thing aside from the system, or what did you feel after that?
In terms of what? In terms of OJ's guilt?
Yeah. Anything.
Well, my opinion of the system it was sort of revealed to me to be so incredibly fragile and so vulnerable to the machinations of very, very clever lawyers who are using the books to help them squeeze through loopholes and to obfuscate and to draw attention away from certain things. I mean, it's that old thing of, you know, once you say something out loud, you can't unring a bell, even if something is, you know, strike that in the courtroom.
Right, right.
If somebody has provided an image or, you know, opened up a question in the jurors' minds, it's out there.
Juries and Fox News.
Well, yeah. Well, and sort of any news. I mean, to some degree, our perceptions are more driven by the media than we'd like to believe, I think.
For
our conditioning is profound.
Mm-hmm. When you do, because you've played some real life people before in the past, obviously throughout your career, is there a bigger responsibility facing it as an actor, or do you approach it the same way going in? You're just going to tell the story that's on the page, or do you feel a need of a connection,
it's tricky sometimes. I mean, if you feel the story on the page doesn't represent exactly what happened, or doesn't represent the point of view of the person in that moment, there's a dilemma of who do you support? Do you support what you believe really happened, or do you support what's in the script? And generally, if you have those kind of issues, you go to the director and the writers and say, okay, this is what I found out. Does this jibe with what you guys are thinking? And they'll say, yes, we know that, but here's something else to give it more context for you, and that's why we wrote the way we did. Or they'll say, oh, well, let's adjust that a little bit. We haven't heard that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Speaking of playing real-life characters, I have to ask you, when you go back, you've played some presidents of the United States in your in your career. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering now, looking at this sort of put you on the spot a little bit, looking at this political landscape right now, who of candidates out there would you think would be a good time to play, or who you would like to play? You think would be a good one?
Who in Canadian politics?
No, I think an American one. Let's start with the American presidents, because presidents are under you're in your oeuvre a little bit. Who do you see as any of the candidates out there do you think would be a hoot to play, or someone you'd like to take a run at?
Well, it'd be fun to play Trump, don't you think?
Yeah.
It'd be fun to play Ted Cruz.
Ted Cruz.
It'd basically be fun to play any of the Republicans.
It's pretty crazy, right? You watch this stuff.
Bananas.
We were talking about
Well, it's like Julia Louis-Dreyfus said when she accepted an award earlier this year. It's getting harder and harder to parody these guys.
Right. From Veep, yeah.
You know? Yeah, I mean, it's wacky.
It really is. You watch the debates and you just think, this is someone's going to, you know, come onto the stage and say, ladies and gentlemen, you know, we put this together for your entertainment, because it's just bananas.
Oh, yeah, they feel as though there's a curtain is going to open up behind them. And a few real candidates will appear, and a grate will open in the floor, and those nine people will drop out of sight, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of like a gong show set. Hey, with up here now, with the new Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, did you have any, your path ever crossed with his father? Did you ever play him in anything, or come close to that?
No, I never met his dad, even though, you know, we grew up in Vancouver, in sort of a generation after him. No.
No, you never. Yeah, no. I thought maybe somewhere along the line you might have been in something where someone was Trudeau next to you.
No, no, I know Colin Fjord played Trudeau, yeah. But I wasn't in that.
Yeah.
In that thing.
So I just, before I let you go, I just wanted to go through a few things on the resume and just sort of get your feeling on. Well, let's start right back at the beginning. Beachcombers, you got to be in Beachcombers.
Yeah, it was terrifying.
How old were you when you did that?
Oh, I think I was probably 20, maybe. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 19 or 20.
Pretty iconic Canadian show. What was terrifying about it? Just because it was new?
Oh, just being in front of a camera and having your heart beat so hard that your shirt is fluttering, you know, and unable to remember your dialogue, even though it's only a line, you know, that kind of scary thing, you know.
Do you still get nervous?
I just sort of walked over to the CBC from my apartment, and suddenly I had a job acting where I had no business having a job acting. But there you go. You're there, and the camera's rolling.
What do you mean you had no business? How did you get? How did you end up with?
Well, I didn't
job?
Have a clue what I was doing. a semester of acting at UBC or half a semester, and that wasn't enough.
It turns out you needed some more work, huh?
It turns out there was a whole lot more heavy lifting to do. Yeah, which continues to this day.
Well, do you still get nervous when you start a new project?
I get excited.
Yeah.
Occasionally I get nervy, but I'd like to tell myself it's excitement and not nerves.
It's a good way.
Probably a combination.
Get through the day with good rationalizations, right?
Tell
me about when you found out about Star Trek, when they said where they wanted you on.
Well, that was a really fun thing. I got a call from my manager and my agent. They said, "Hey, JJ Abrams wants to talk to you." And I said, "Oh, ooh, okay, great." He called. I was in Toronto shooting something, and he said, "Hey, we'd like you to play Chris Pike in the next Star Trek, and this new Star Trek thing that's coming out." And I went, "Oh, that sounds odd. Could you send me a script?" And he goes, "No." What do you mean? You can't. I said, "Well, you can come to Paramount when you get back to town, and we'll lock you in a room, and you can read the script then. How about that?"
Wow.
With a guard at the door. And I went, "Okay, that sounds good." And so that was my first introduction to the wild, wild, expensive security that most big pictures have now. You know, of course, I read it and I thought it was super exciting. And that was that.
Pike was in the original TV show. He was the one with just the head in the box, right?
Well, you know, Dana, that's a little unfair. He ended up that way. He was not just not a head on a box. That's
sorry. He was the very first episode.
I think you should just relax on that a little bit.
Okay,
that's
I won't.
A little harsh.
I won't say that when I'm at the next Star Trek convention I have to cover, because I have done those.
Chances are that's where you'd end up.
I have, yeah, I have done those. You've obviously been to a few of those, I would imagine, huh?
Yeah, I've been to a handful, yeah. But they're great. They're really, really,
it's really
much more
fun,
than
isn't
I ever
it? Yeah, I thought they were really fun. I just, people are so sweet at them, and you know,
aren't they? And they're into it.
Yeah, I know.
And it's not, you know, it's sort of, you know, leave your pretensions at the door, and everybody's into the same thing. It's like, yeah, it's very joyful. It's really, I've been really touched a bunch of times talking to people at those things. It's you come away pretty energized and very grateful.
What kind of things do those people at those events ask you? What's sort of a common question?
Well, for me, the most common question in the last couple of years has been, "Are you coming back? You know, are they going to reanimate you somehow?" It's not so much that, strangely, that they want to know things about you. It's that they want to tell you some of their story.
Oh, interesting.
So you spend a lot of time being, you know, when I first saw the first Star Trek, is I met my husband on the Paramount lot, and you know, and unfortunately he passed away from cancer last year, but this is our daughter, and this is our 20th anniversary of our meeting at the Star Trek thing. And it's, you know, it's just like, it's beautiful.
That's an interesting thing to be a part of. Having gone to a few of those conventions, I have to admit the Star Trek one I've always found is a lot better than just straight Comic-Con. The Comic-Con stuff seems a little pervy. The Star Trek stuff, not so much.
I've been to Comic-Con a couple times, but only sort of on the other side of the tables, and it's just a madhouse.
It's just the outfits.
It's an absolute madhouse. It's fun, but it's, wow, you really need oxygen afterwards.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, I have to ask you, too, while I have you here, John from Cincinnati, what the hell was going on in that show?
Yes.
Oh, yes. I mean, I love David Mills, but what the hell was going on? What happened
Oh,
there?
Yes. was... Yes.
Any answer to that, Bruce?
No.
No.
I think, you know, per David Milch, he said, look, you'll under, when I would ask him that very same question, he would say 100 episodes in, it'll be clear.
And how many episodes did you get?
I don't know. I think we were probably 90 shy of a real explanation.
And even at the end, when the show didn't go forward, he didn't come clean with anybody what it was about? Was he God? Was he Jesus? Who was that? Who was John?
I don't know. And I think, you know, David probably had an idea of who he was while he was writing it. But he's such a tremendously creative guy, as I'm sure you can imagine, that he was probably keeping his options open should he have a better idea, which he probably would have.
Right. I guess sometimes when you're expecting to do a longer series, sometimes it's just a matter of evolution of the character and the story, I guess, as well, right?
Yeah, you get it started with characters that inspire you, and then you let them begin to speak, and then you let the actors play them, and
then you smoke some more pot.
Yeah, see what resonates, what doesn't resonate, where the fire is, where it isn't, all that.
Perfect. And yeah. Sort of, you know, like I said, we had you on here today to talk about rehearsal. We did it, but I would be completely remiss if I didn't bring up Mad Men. Seeing you show up at the last part of Mad Men, that was pretty exciting.
Yeah, that was a hard secret to keep. I had to keep that under my, you know, under my period cap for a year.
No kidding. Now, were you able to tell anybody?
Told my wife
mm-hmm.
and my best friend.
That was it. Right. And he was kind
that
of
was
a
absolutely it.
Yeah, and what was that like being? What did it feel like being on that show, knowing you were at the very end of it, and it was such a big icon in television?
Well, there was a lot of, you know, I just sort of stepped in for a moment, and there was a, you know, you could really feel that everybody was trying to gear themselves up for saying goodbye, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, didn't want to talk about it for the first three or four episodes I did. And
okay.
Yeah, people were, you know, they didn't want to talk about it until sort of the very last episode. They all would just say, oh, God, no, I'm just going to get too wound up. You know,
right.
You know, I'd say, well, how do you feel about it coming to an end? I can't talk about it today. Yeah.
Right. It's like the sad elephant in the room. Bruce, I realize it sounds like you're at LAX now, but just before I let you go, one last thing. Just because you've had this amazing long career and you've done so many different things and you're heading up to a film festival, which is usually the stomping ground for a lot of young talent and filmmakers, I'm wondering if you could advise, what kind of advice would you give to somebody who wants to start in this business?
Oh, that's a good question. I think, I don't know, the business is so different now than when I was in the position they find themselves in. Just do it because you love it, because there's no guarantees.
Right. Well, Bruce Green...
Yeah, and the more you love it, the harder you'll work. So.
And you still love it by the sounds of it.
I do. Yeah. Well, you love what you do, right?
Yeah, some days. Some days.
Yeah, I mean, do I love every day? No, but I... there's always something... The great thing about it is it's always changing.
Right.
You know?
And here you're off to a beautiful ski hill in the mountains just to have your film be talked about and to get yourself a fancy prize.
And get myself, get myself a little glittering a bauble. Come on.
What's not to love? Well, Bruce, thanks so much for chatting with us today. Congratulations on the movie. It's really lovely.
Oh, thanks. I'm really, really glad you liked it because I'm so close to it, we just don't know anymore.
Yeah, true. All right, you have a safe trip.
Okay, thanks, Dan.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, the East End's not that bad. In the centre of the earth could be anywhere you like.
Even here?
Yeah, even here.
In Bethnal Green?
Yeah, Bethnal Green.
Do you like being a gangster?
I'm not a gangster. I'm a club owner. I like the money, and I like the respect of being a club owner. I'm not a gangster.
Alrighty, that is a clip from Legend. As you can tell, it's time for movies here on the DGP, and that means one thing and one thing only. more of me. No, just kidding. Oh, I kid.
Wow.
Jim Gordon.
She does not kid, folks.
Jim Gordon is in the house. Hi, Jim Gordon.
Hi, welcome back. You got a nice tan.
Thank you. Thank you.
She's got a nice tan, folks. Really nice tan.
I do.
Tan.
I got a tan for radio or whatever this is, podcasting.
Podcasting.
Okay, so this is one of those weeks because I was away. I missed a bunch of screenings, so we kind of have an abridged version of this today. Although I will let you, I'm going to let you talk about some movies that you've seen and I haven't.
Right.
It's only because you mean so much to me.
Thank you.
All right. First thing up, Legend. Let's talk about Legend. Now, this is a much, much hyped about movie. I mean, I think, well, for us, it has been. We've been wanting to see this for a long time. This is Tom Hardy, who can't do anything wrong, can he?
Not in the last 5-6 years, no.
No, he hasn't done anything wrong, has he? He's super hot, too.
He's Steve McQueen, Paul Newman hot.
Oh,
I think he's a good looking. He's a good looking guy. And he's got the chops to match it, too.
And he can play bad guys, too, which I like. What's this movie about? Legend, we should sort of obviously tell you what it's about. This is a film based on the story of the notorious, and I use the word notorious not in quotation marks, but in capital letters, the Cray twins, the Cray brothers, from who basically wreaked havoc over the East End of London in the early to mid-1960s. I think they were both finally arrested, the two of them, in 1968 for a murder. One murder, two murders. There was a lot of murders. So these guys are an interesting story in that because it was London in the swinging 60s, they ran nightclubs, they had nice suits. They actually became friends with like regular people, well, regular, like celebrities and stuff.
Yeah,
they were photographed by the great David Bailey. They, one of the brothers, there was a sex scam. One of the brothers is gay, or he says bisexual. Let's face facts. He's gay.
Yeah.
He's pretty gay. He had a sex scandal with an MP, which you have to have a sex scandal with the MP if you're anybody in London in the 60s,
right.
Aren't you?
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, very true. I didn't realize there was such volatility in their relationship. And we should say, folks, Tom Hardy playing both brothers.
Yeah, didn't I say that? Yeah, that's the
cinematic
whoops.
Marvel.
It's really well shot.
It
and,
is.
And he does two completely different characters in that, even though they're twins, they're two, one's nuts as a bunny. That would be Ronnie, who is the homosexual and sadistic and off his nut, let's just say.
A bipolar times 10.
Yeah, like and Reggie. And Reggie's the other one who's just... who's just a gangster, a violent gangster. But they're super violent gangsters. And I liked the movie because I went in knowing the story of this. There was a great movie actually made in, I think, 1990 called The Craze, which starred the two brothers from Spandau Ballet.
The Kemp brothers. Yeah, was it good?
Yeah, well, it was good in a kind of a cheesy gangster movie.
Okay.
Yeah,
right.
It's go back and see if you can find it. But these, you know what? We have this thing with mob stuff and mafiosos, don't we? We always want to watch them. I mean, Tony Soprano, whatever, Godfather. These guys are really no different. They're just, you know, it's kind of hip and hot happening in London in the 60s.
Yeah. And it's funny. I said to you after the movie, the one thing that all these gangsters and then their movies point out is these guys do that one big mistake, amongst many, but to survive. And Meyer Lansky comes into the picture halfway through the movie. And so the American mob is taking note of these boys in London. They come over and want to work a deal with them. But these guys get to a point where they think they're bigger and better than the law. And they just get careless. And that's what Meyer Lansky, until you know they deported him in the 70s, he managed to avoid by just keeping below the radar. Just making enough, but also not being photographed in the paper and not having celebrities on your arm and all that. Because as you said, their clubs were the places to go in the 60s, right?
It's interesting. They had all this sort of stuff. And they ended up in this club called Esmeralda's Barn, which they own, which is nefariously changed hands. Like, you know, gangsters do that. Racehorses and nightclubs. Seem to change hands without any
we'd like to buy this club from you or we'll kill you.
Yeah, that's the deal.
That's the deal.
low interest rates.
Yeah,
Now, I have a little of a side to this because I know somebody who...
This blew me away. Explain this character that you actually
met. I'm friends with a fellow who... I'm going to give out his full name. A guy named Mike that I've known for a few years who used to run with the Krays. In fact, he was in a relationship with one of their main henchmen who's portrayed in this movie, Mad Teddy Smith, who is quite mad. And my friend Mike... I asked him about after seeing the film. Well, first of all, I'm just going to say what I thought. I thought the film was a solid 7.
That's what I gave it.
Yeah. It could have been a bit better. I was a bit distracted by Tom Hardy's Ronnie because I don't think that there was a lot of space for humor in this. And I don't know if it's been intentional in the Brian Hagelin script or how it was directed, but there were times at the movie theater, I thought, where people were laughing. And I was like, is he looking for a laugh here or not? I don't know.
Yeah, he's I'll tell you what, surprising too, in that environment, he was the first openly... declaring his homosexuality character. I mean, he makes no bones about it with the Chicago mobster. He says, I like boys. That's which today, no one would say, but late 60s in a rough environment like that. Also, I think his performance is an 8 or 9 out of 10.
Oh, yeah.
We should say to people, though, if you are really unfamiliar with the accent,
yeah,
it will take you a while. You may miss chunks.
At the very beginning of Ronnie's beginning. Voice, because he's kind of marble-mouthed, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But well, like back to the point where there's some comedy, it seems, in it. My friend who knew these guys said that there was nothing funny about Ronnie Cray. And he actually told me a bunch of really interesting stories about sort of how he was warned, you know, don't let Ronnie catch your eye or don't catch his eye. Like really like scary stuff. And he said it was scary, but it had this side to it. And he said, too, that was their downfall, was that they got too flashy.
Yeah, yeah.
Stop getting so flashy, you know.
And they end up going away for one murder each, right?
Yeah.
that's what it worked out to.
Yeah, when you could stack the bodies.
Yeah,
up high.
But they had the MPs in their pocket.
Right, because there was, like I said, you have to have a sex scandal.
And they just, all these guys, these MPs that would go to these gay orgies and everything, like they had it all
gay
photographed.
Orgies. That was the name of your second album.
It was actually second album, very big. But it's for me, performance-wise, 9 out of 10, but the movie's about is a 7. You're not going for the movie. You're going to see the marvel of what they can do now with technology.
Yeah,
you know?
It was really great. There's very few times they resort to just the back of someone's head, right? He's actually on camera with himself quite a bit.
Yeah, well, you remember the old days growing up, it was like they just split the frame down the middle, right? You'd be here, and then they'd shoot you over here. There's none of that, really. Yeah. They have fight scenes. They're in cars. I mean, Tom Hardy has just delivered two spectacular performances.
And you know who I also liked in it? I thought Emily Browning was great as the sort of beleaguered girlfriend, then
she
wife.
Was, yes.
Who is actually the narrator of the story.
Yeah,
it's her voice who narrates.
Yeah, there's some good. You'll see some recognizable faces. David Thewlis is good in this, who's the guy that keeps warning them to guys, bring it down, bring it down. You're just getting too big and too well known. But interesting. I'm glad someone did a story of these two guys.
It's the mobster stuff. We love it.
Right? Yeah, 7 out of 10 for both of us. Yeah.
Yeah, we agreed on that one today. Okay, I, like I said earlier, had a week off, so I didn't see anything. The only thing I watched while I was away was I finally watched all of Narcos, I liked it. I thought it was okay. I thought the performance, the guy who played Pablo Escobar, I thought was fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
But I discovered another good one. Have you heard of River yet with Stellan Skarsgård? BBC
Love
cop
him.
Show.
Love
I know, me too. Like me a big Viking.
Where'd you discover that?
On the Netflix.
On the Netflix?
Yeah, on the Netflix. I like to call it.
Do we need a the in front of that?
I do like it. It's like Kermit the Frog.
Well, that's going to be my
It's called River. It's a 6-parter, I think, from BBC.
Oh, I like that. Good.
Oh, well, you do like that. You like that.
No, it's like the one with Gillian Anderson last year, The Fall. It's like 6 episodes.
Well, it's because then it's all good. Yeah, it doesn't get watered down. Yeah. Okay, enough about my viewing, except for the fact that I didn't see anything else this week that's opening. So, Jim, take it away.
We should just mention, staying in that British historical theme, I mentioned to you earlier that there's a completely opposite type movie coming out this week called A Royal Night Out, which is based on the long-told story that on VE Day in May of 45, the princesses, Margaret and Elizabeth, were allowed to go out and mix amongst their royal subjects for really the first time. And it's just this comedic romp about what their evening might have been like. You've got good performances by both the actresses playing the princesses. But it's interesting that back then, one of the princesses could go out, you know, with a incognito, like a hood or whatever like that, and people wouldn't immediately point because they'd been seen but not seen.
Well, because they weren't all over, there's no interwebs.
Yeah, yeah.
So they'd been seen, and they hadn't even been seen on any money yet.
No, exactly. But I always assumed.
So when would they see them? Just waving from the balcony?
Or, you know, in well-orchestrated news clips and everything. But
right.
I guess to see them up close, somebody finally recognizes Margaret and goes, oh my God, it's P2. And from
Princess
that point,
too.
Yeah, yeah. So.
Well, it's not like they were sort of, and not taking it in any thing away from them. They're not like, you know, bright blondes or bright gingers. You know, they're
brown haired
girls.
Brown haired women, yeah.
Yeah,
who,
regular.
Who went out.
How old were they when they were supposedly going out on this night on the town?
I think Margaret would have probably been about, maybe 18, 19.
I'm guessing Margaret probably had more fun than Elizabeth.
Margaret had more fun, I see. Yeah, you can see where that's going, can't you?
I can see where Margaret ended up.
Well, you've got Margaret. What was the guy that she was in a relationship with
Snowden?
That she wanted to marry? Snowden. Mm-hmm. Wasn't allowed in the late 50s. So you can measure pre and post that breakup, breakup.
Gay? Is that not a problem?
No, I can't. He was a commoner, I think. He was divorced.
He's a photographer.
He was divorced, though, wasn't he?
He was divorced. You know,
I think that's what it was.
And you're only allowed to get divorced if you're trying to break up with Hitler.
Yeah. Yes. But listen, it's a cute little romp.
Is it? You liked it?
I did. I like anything British. And this is just a cute kind of what might have happened.
I'm still thinking about Margaret and Elizabeth. So is Elizabeth the one? I'm not going to use that expression because
she is the responsible one of the two. But they ditch their two bodyguards.
And then
they just get into one romp after another. But there's tons of... there's tons of great recognizable faces, And she's just making a face now, folks.
Anyways, recognizable faces, so it's good.
Yeah, no, there's a couple of faces from British television that if you watch a lot of British television, what you and I do, you'll recognize. So, yeah, this is another 7 out of 10. But we've got tons of movies for December, though.
If we eventually get caught up. But we should also point out, you heard earlier on the show I was interviewing the lovely Bruce Greenwood, venerable Canadian actor. He's been in everything. I think he's even going to be doing My Life Story.
Yeah. He looks more like you than you. He,
he does. Skinnier than I am.
I was looking at his bio this morning. I'd forgotten that he goes back to like St. Elsewhere in the mid-80s.
Beachcombers. He was 19 years old. He started on Beachcombers. That's what he told us about that, how nervous he was.
Oh, are you serious?
So he's at the film festival with a new film, Rehearsal, which I've seen. It's just great. You're going to watch later, and I know you're going to like it. The Whistler Film Festival, the 15th year for the film festival. You know, this is a good little film festival because they actually get some great big, small films.
They get
all the Oscar bait because they want to bring out movies that are coming out right now, which is all the Oscar bait.
Well, I think they're opening night movies. Carol, right?
Yeah. The Lady in the Van is up there, which have you watched that yet?
No, I can't wait.
Yeah.
I hear good things.
Oh, yeah.
Although, you know, for people that are listening right now, it comes out in Vancouver, I think, in like early to mid-January.
Yeah.
But it's supposed to be great. Oh, I can't wait to see that.
All right. Well, that's it for us today on the movie front. So check out Legend. And what was the one you called? I'm still stuck on Margaret trying to get rid of Elizabeth at the nightclubs.
A Royal Night Out.
A Royal Night Out.
All right. Nice tan.
Thank you. That's what we're going to have, a Royal Night Out. See ya. Okay, that's it for this episode of the DGP. Bruce Greenwood. Boy, I love talking to him, Adam. I've talked to him years ago for other things, but wasn't he great?
You know, I always say this, but he was a nice guy.
I know. You do always say that, because you're often surprised that people are actually nice.
I know. I just think they're all going to be at a-holes.
Oh, really? Yeah, especially when they're big-time actors. Well, I think with someone like him who works in so many different things and isn't, you know, in the giant trailer, isn't have the name above the credits sort of things or above the title. Anyways, he's great. And if you want to just go check out his resume. Like, seriously, he's been in everything. And when Rehearsal finally gets a release to theaters, make sure you see that movie. It's a lovely, lovely little film. Okay, so what was I doing? Oh, I was saying goodbye. Okay, before we go, we'd like to do the usual thank yous. Adam, as usual, thank you for your attention.
You're welcome.
I enjoy you paying attention to me. Something like that. I'd also like to thank Jim Gordon from CTV for coming in and doing movies. He's always a good time. At least that's what I hear. What is wrong with me today?
I don't know.
It's weird. Okay, and Bruce Greenwood. Yeah, like I said. Oh, and also, if you are listening to this podcast today on Friday or over the weekend, and you've got some time, head up to Whistler for the film festival. They actually have a lot of really great films, and it's a chance to get up into the mountains. All right, I'm done talking. So that's it. Remember to check us out on theprovince.com/podcast or on Stitcher, iTunes, and TuneIn. Also follow The Province Podcast on Periscope. Thanks a lot for listening, and keep it real.
You've been listening to the DGP, hosted by province writer Dana G. Follow Dana on Twitter at Dana_G or read her stories on theprovince.com. Subscribe to this and other great province podcasts by searching iTunes or clicking the links available on theprovincepodcasts.com.